This is the Muscles and Management Podcast, where we build your body and your business. Talking all things training, sports performance, and business for athletes and aspiring coaches to enhance your training and better your career. Muscles and Management is brought to you by Challenger Strength with your host, Jerry DiFilippo.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to episode 82 of the Muscles and Management Podcast. As always, please rate, review, and subscribe if you have not already. Greatly appreciate it. Thrilled today. Really, really awesome episode coming your way with Tony Holler. Just a fantastic episode when it comes to speed development, conditioning for team sport athletes. Just a guy that really gets it and is, really sought after in the track and field, world, and is, you know, his stuff is becoming more known in the team sport training world, and he's been someone that I've learned a good deal from, and I love what he has to say about energy systems and the way he theorizes making sure that we're sprinting and doing things at full speed, not running long distances and wearing athletes out with things that aren't really relating to sport and things like that. So thrilled to have him today, and I don't want to keep this too long because I want to get right into it, but if you haven't yet, check out Monday's episode, Meathead Monday, another Q&A talking about resisted sprinting, post-activation potentiation, or PAP, and contrast training. If you want an explanation of what that is, because it sounds fancy, just check out the episode and other various topics from my DMs and questions that I get. So check that out for sure if you haven't yet. And then last week, we had head of sports performance for the St. Louis Blues of the NHL, Eric Renahan, a really great episode as well. So be on the lookout for those. And then next week, episode 84 on Wednesday, we're going to have Jason Spray. Jason makes his return to the show. He was on last year, and he's a really, really high-level sports performance coach, works with a lot of high-level athletes, former Middle Tennessee State strength coach for football, trains Kevin Byard from the Tennessee Titans All-Pro Safety, and just has a wealth of experience in the field and does some really great stuff, keeps it simple, easy to understand, and just an episode that's going to be, great for coaches and athletes to take some valuable stuff that they can apply right away to their training. So I hope you guys enjoy today's episode with Tony. Let me know what you think and give me some feedback on it. And stay tuned for some awesome guests coming forward. I have episodes recorded to the 9th of September as we speak. So I kind of went after it in quarantine and got a lot done. And there's just some awesome, awesome guests coming up that I know you guys are going to love. So enjoy this episode with Tony, and I will talk to you guys next time. Peace. All right, everyone. Excited to welcome on Tony Holler. Tony, thanks so much for your time. I'm excited to have you, and I think it's going to be a great episode.
Yeah, I'm just glad to have somebody to talk to during these crazy times. It's nice to have an adult in the room.
Yeah, it's been interesting and I guess unique for all of us. How are you holding up with everything and, what's going on and being kind of stuck inside for the last few weeks?
Well, obviously, it's a killer, for so many people. I mean, this is my 39th year as a track coach, and it's the first spring that, we haven't had track, and you go back to, your times in college, high school, middle school, all that stuff. There's no such thing as a spring off, and I'm 61 years old, and that's just a lot of habits that, down the drain. But I'm very lucky. I'm the type of guy that can, I can read 2 or 3 hours a day. I can write 2 or 3 hours a day. I can talk forever on a podcast. I just listen to a podcast with Latif Thomas and Lee Tate. And, so I got a lot of things like that I can do. I imagine some people are going crazy.
Yeah, it's been tough. I guess I can agree with you on the sense that I've been staying very busy trying to get a lot of episodes recorded and obviously training all of my athletes remotely and everything. But even with all of that, it's still just a weird feeling to not be able to just get up in the morning and go to work and just do what you're used to, doing every day. So it's been, I guess, an eye opener for everybody. And, I was talking to my mom about it the other day, and she was saying that she thinks it'll really make us kind of come out of the other side of it and appreciate, the little things in life that much more. And I would definitely agree with that.
Yeah. And it's scary. I don't know when we're going to come out of this. Somebody said the other day that they're hoping that maybe get back to normal in fall of 2021. I just can't, that can't happen, but then again, we can't have 2 million people dead either. So this is crazy stuff.
Yeah, it's going to be a waiting game. And, I've kind of made it for myself where it's I don't really I try not to listen to it too much because no one knows much of anything right now other than like what's right in front of us. So it's hard to, you know, I know personally I'll drive myself crazy if I keep looking at like, when are we going to go back? When are we going to do this? Like I've been better lately about just kind of like trying to do what's right in front of me and kind of, you know, keep pushing along with that. But yeah, we'll see. I mean, it's like you said, the most important thing is to make sure that we keep as many people, you know, from death as possible. So we'll kind of see where we come out of it. But I want to kind of start things off basically, and I like to do this with any of the coaches that I have on for as much as a purpose of me learning about them, you know, that for the listener as well. But like, kind of take us through a little bit of your philosophies and influences, if you will, like coaches, mentors, like who has influenced your coaching style and kind of how you work with your athletes the most.
Yeah, well, I mean, as I said, I'm 61 years old and I've coached for 39 years. But I always, whenever I do a brief history of myself, I always call myself a coach's kid for 61 years. My father was a head basketball coach on the day that I was born in 1959. I believe he's in his first year of coaching at that time. He went on to coach 47 years, 44 as a head basketball coach at a high school or college level. And being his first son, he took me everywhere, probably even, you know, when I was 3 or 4 years old. And I think he talked to me like I was a grown up from a very early age. And so I was kind of his wingman. And when I became a head basketball coach myself, that was my first coaching gig and all I really wanted to do. And I was a head basketball coach for 9 years back in the 80s. And you know, after every game, I would call him and you know, tell him about my game. And he'd tell me about his game. And so anyway, it's been, you know, coaching has been in my blood that entire time. Now, what's really weird, though, is I would say my other biggest influence is my son, Alec, who is my oldest son. And he's also a coach. And I think that he and I have had that same relationship that my dad and I had, where he was my wingman. I always spoke to him like he's an adult. And you know, I think we've shared everything. You know, I was his coach, just like my dad was my coach. I was his teacher, just like my dad was my teacher in history back in 1973. So it's very weird. And Alec, like myself, is extremely opinionated. And he's one of the few people who have kind of the guts to call me out on things. And it's so important because a lot of us are surrounded by yes men. And you know, that's just the way of the world these days. Nobody wants, you know, to challenge anyone. So Alec has been very, very important. And then probably the third guy is Chris Corfist, who has become my business partner. I met him 10 years ago. And Chris, of course, is the co-owner of RPR, Reflexive Performance Reset. And he and I run the Track Football Consortium together. And the great thing about Chris is that he's like the yin to my yang, you know, that he's different than me. You know, he's a gadget guy and I'm not. He's a history teacher and I'm a science teacher. He's a capitalist and I'm a socialist. I mean, we are like opposites in every way. But once again, I think that's when we grow, is when we surround ourselves with people smarter than we are. And then we accept the fact that we can be different. And that's probably the best way to learn.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you made a great point too. Like, how many times I can say personally in my career and with my coaching, like how I've learned from people that maybe have a different way of, or a different perspective of looking at things. And I would say even as like a strength coach, and like, obviously we're going to talk a lot about speed today, but I think as a strength coach, like there's so many areas, or a sports performance coach better yet, there's so many areas, you know, of what goes into what we do with athletes. Like I'm writing something right now about like, you know, how I've implemented some bodybuilding principles for, you know, improving and increasing size in athletes, and what I've learned from track coaches, and how I've implemented plyometrics and some powerlifting principles. Like it's a blend as a strength coach and a sports performance coach of everything. So I think personally, like talking to people like you for me, or people that are like, you know, really, really experts in one area, has been eye opening for me because I take a little bit from each of them. And I think it makes me a better coach for sure. So I 100% understand where you're coming from with that. And I think that was, you know, a great point.
Yeah. And I think the whole thing about, you know, I actually like it when people disagree with me or challenge me, because because it makes, I mean, I'm pretty damn confident in a lot of the things we do. And I just get better at explaining what we do when people challenge me. And then the other thing is sometimes people challenge me and I'm like, I can't defend that, you know, and you fall on your sword and say, yeah, I don't have that right. And not enough people ever go through those learning moments. And Lord knows I've done some really dumb things in my coaching career.
Yeah, I think that that's a really good point as well. Like the, and we're going to get to this a little bit, so I don't want to, you know, run to it now, but like, we're going to talk a little bit about, you know, the misconceptions regarding energy systems and a lot of what's out there. And I find the more I have to explain it, on a place like Twitter, the better I get at like reasoning with it myself and understanding it even more. I think that's kind of huge. And if you do have confidence in what you're doing, and not only confidence, but like you can kind of have confidence in the fact that, you know, you've seen it work with your athletes. That's a big part of it too. Like I know Mike Boyle says it a lot, like how important it is to actually be in the facility with actual athletes, like training them over a, like a long period of time. You can really build a, you know, a big base of data that's just right in front of you. Like it works with them. I've seen it work. Like kind of here's how I know that. And that's why I'm going to kind of, you know, stand behind it. So I think that's huge as well.
Yeah, I think Mike Boyle's a friend of mine, and you know, he flew me out to Boston a couple years ago, and we're the same age and all that stuff. And sometimes when you're our age, you start talking like you're 61. And you know, one of the things that I have learned is that you know, you may have learned something from somebody who really knows what they're talking about, but you haven't learned the nuance. That's one of my favorite words these days. You know, like an offensive coordinator can plug in an offense that he's studied all summer, and it will look like the offense that Urban Meyer runs or whoever. But that coach does not have the nuance of how to coach that offense. The little things are the things that make the difference. And so I think that's the thing that comes with experience. And I love talking about those little things.
Yeah, absolutely. So kind of a little bit of a segue into, you know, the meat and potatoes of the speed stuff that I want to talk to you about. If you had to best characterize the way in which you train athletes to get them faster, I know this is kind of hard to say, and I'm kind of putting you on the spot here, but like if there was a way that you could characterize that, or multiple ways, in terms of like your style and like what your approach, like what would you say that is and how would you characterize it?
Well, it's really what I never expected or planned to brand anything Feed the Cats, but it's happened, you know, and it's something that I kind of said in jest, you know, 21 years ago, and now it's actually the name of my business, and it gets some
funny,
people
funny how that
wonder.
Works, right?
It is, you know, a lot of people that are known for inventing stuff never had planned to invent anything. It just kind of organically grew. But the whole Feed the Cats mentality started in 1999 when I wanted to attract fast twitch athletes to my track program, good athletes, you know, like wide receivers and basketball players who could dunk and so forth. And what I learned, my whole premise is that cats are athletes that are extremely competitive and talented, but they don't want to run. They don't like running. Mm-hmm. So I simply shamelessly did away with running in my practices, where I said, we're not going to freaking run anymore. And the kids looked at me like, well, what are we going to do? And I said, we're just going to sprint in extremely small doses with large rest. And on days that we don't sprint, we're basically going to jump and do some mobility things. And we're going to be done in 45 minutes, and practice will be the best part of your day. Now, I did that as basically an experiment where I would shamelessly get all those great athletes onto my track team, and we would beat the hell out of every other track team that could not attract those kids to their track team. And so it worked. But what I did not realize is a part of Feed the Cats is the fact that we record, rank, and publish times. That kids that are not spiked up and not being timed are not sprinting. And they're not sprinting if you do not record, rank, and publish what they do, because they will just run then. So we put that much focus on what we're doing, so much intent, that when kids do that, all the kids got faster. Even like the freshmen that came to me as half-assed athletes, you know, like, why are we wasting our time with these kids? They came back as sophomores much, much better. And they all came back as well because they love the sport. And so that whole idea about being extremely specific in what we do, and the two things that are central to Feed the Cats is essentialism, which, you know, any coach or parent or anybody that has not read the book Essentialism, it's just a must read. So, you know, we do the essentials and we cut out the bullshit. And then the other thing is hormesis, which is basically a pharmacological idea where everything's a poison, nothing's a poison. It all depends on the dose. Mm. So dosage to me is so important that we never want to burn the steak. We never want to let today ruin tomorrow. And that tired is the enemy and not the goal. So all those things, you know, are the overarching principles that guide what we do in sprinting, and it really works.
Yeah. All right. Wow. So there's a lot to kind of unpack there. No, I mean, listen, I could probably pick 9 or 10 things that I'd want to go off onto separate little tangents with, but I think all of it really is a great kind of transition and segue to like a lot of the things that I want to talk to you about in terms of sprinting. And a great way to kind of start out. And a lot of the stuff you mentioned and you talked to, especially like the last little minute there, is the idea of the, you know, minimum effective dose and, you know, the whole sprint fast to get fast thing. And you mentioned timing athletes to make sure, you know, that they're exerting or running at max speed or sprinting, not running. And that's a great way to look at it that I never really kind of separated it that way. But obviously, I will now kind of explain it that way because I think it makes it really easy to explain. But there's, in my opinion, from what you see around not only social media, and I say social media because I feel like that's such a vent, you know, a place now where you can kind of put your ideas out there and anything like that. So if you see it on social media, odds are it is kind of, prevalent in the industry, so to speak. And there's a lot of talk about the significance of sprinting fast to get faster and how important that is to like the whole plyo effect of sprinting. And, you know, you mentioned like when we're tired and not recovered, you know, we're not really getting faster and fatigue is the enemy in that sense. Why do you think there is still such a misconception or misunderstanding, at least to a lot of people in the sport world that I see, you know, that have trouble understanding that if you're not doing it at max speed and there's not full recovery, you're not really sprinting to get faster. You're not sprinting at all, really.
Yeah, well, I call it really the religion of our sport. And, you know, some people call it the Protestant work ethic that's a part of all of us. But we've all worshiped at the altar of hard work will always win.
You know, how do you grind, right? The grind.
Right. And I speak against the grind, whereas I would say the majority of coaches worship the grind. Yep. And I think they do that because that's how they were brought up. And in our DNA, it's really strange. Human, especially men, have in their DNA something that almost makes us all victims of the Stockholm syndrome, where we look back at damn near abusive relationships we had in sports and with our coaches and stuff, and we look back with fondness. That it's kind of like a military situation. It's kind of like a band of brothers type of thing where coach beat the hell out of all of us, but we all were really good friends. And so somehow we just repeat that cycle of abuse. And the problem is when you worship the grind, one of the things I say about football coaches, they're probably the worst at this. I love football coaches, but they're the worst at this, is the fact that I've gotten many really good football coaches to admit that they would rather lose than to be called soft. If they ever lost and people claim that they were being outworked, you know, that would be just the worst thing in the world. And to me, you know, what I want racehorses. I want high performance. I don't care what people think about my training methods. You know, they can call me a pussy if they want, you know, but if my kids are healthy and happy and powerful and fast and, you know, we're winning most of the games, or at least the games that we're supposed to win, that's all that matters to me. I'm not in some type of ego thing about, we're the hardest working team in America and all that kind of stuff. And I just think that, I mean, when I say tired is the enemy, not the goal, I truly believe that most coaches, are their number one goal is to get their kids tired. And, you know, the quote that's out there everywhere that, you know, any fool can get another fool tired.
Yeah.
And the worst coaches, I think, work the hardest. I mean, and they pat themselves on the back for all the hard work they do. And feed the cast just turns that upside down. And it's exciting because it's, you know, one of the greatest things is it's good for coaches too. You know, if your dose is lower, you have more time with your family and your wife and all those things. So it's really a good thing for everybody.
Yeah, I think you really hit the nail on the head there with coaches, like, especially in the times we're in now with this whole quarantine thing. It's like putting this air this idea out there that, like, you're, and I hate to keep saying the word grind, but I say it sarcastically because I feel like, you know, so many think that they really need to, like, wear themselves out to a nub to really be doing anything effective. And, you know, we all heard that expression before, work smart, not hard. And it's not saying be lazy. It's saying, like, be organized and have everything kind of spread out in a sense that, like, you can do work efficiently and get stuff done. But, like, as you said, like, have time for your family. Like, even me as a younger coach, like, I want to still have time to spend with my parents, like, while they're still in good health and I'm able to spend time with them and then eventually have a family someday and, like, be able to, you know, be a good father. Like, you really need to space this stuff out and do it the right way and come away with the mentality or get away from the mentality that, like, if you're not, you know, sleeping 2 hours or, you know, working yourself to the bone. And on the other sense, as an athlete or as a coach of athletes, like, you know, you're not making your athletes puke or throw up after practice. Like, you could still have a very good practice and you probably are having a way better practice if they're not doing that because, you know, you're doing things that are more in line with the sport. And, you know, what's better than, you know, having athletes perform when they're at their best and they're most recovered and they could exert, you know, their max output. Like, to me, that's a no brainer.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I could make, with the possible exception of endurance sports, you know, I think if you're going to be a really good 10,000 meter runner or marathoner, you got to do a shit ton of running, you know, I mean, but for speed and power sports, I think that you could say that whether it's the weight room or the track or the basketball court or the football field, that if you cut your time in half, let's say, or a third, you know, let's say instead of 3 hours in the weight room, you have an hour. Mm-hmm. I think your intensity automatically improves. Your focus improves.
Yeah.
You also have to make choices on what things are the most important.
Yeah.
You know, I quote the Pareto rule all the time that 20% of our stuff leads to 80% of our results. And everybody always agrees with that. But the problem is those people who agree really have not spent the time to figure out what 20% of what they're doing is the most important. And so the whole making a priority out of the essentials, you know, that's essentialism. When you really prioritize your time, you will get more done. And one of my sayings is do less, achieve more. Well, what does that mean on the track? That means full intensity, spiked up. If we're not spiked up and getting time, then we're not sprinting. That means that that we have to have full recovery. We take a full five minutes between sprints.
Yep.
And, you know, that looks lazy. You know, I've had coaches, it's funny, I had coaches visit a lot, and they'll say, hey, you know, your kids are down there kind of playing grab ass, you know, in between 40s. Have you ever thought about stations?
Their heart rate's not up. It's like,
you know, they want me to do stations. And I go, hell no.
Yeah. Am I training their aerobic capacity or am I actually getting them faster? Like, what am I doing? Yeah.
But you know what I mean? People have been taught that if you're not in constant motion, that somehow the coach is not a good coach. In football practice, when I consult with football coaches, I say the hardest thing that you're going to have to do with Feed the Cats is to stop hustling from drill to drill. Matter of fact, you're going to have to get rid of probably half your drills because they're BS anyway. But that whole hustle in between actually lowers the speed at which you can do the next rep, that you have to start really thinking of recovery and making recovery more important than how your football practice looks to the dads that are standing over there on the sideline want you to work their kids to death. So it's really just, you know, caring about what matters and you know, cutting down the volume and prioritizing what matters.
Yeah. And I think you made a great point too. Like, I can't tell you how many times, you know, and I'll be the first to admit it. I've only been in the coaching game for 4 years now. I'm young, but like, I have had a good deal of experience in those 4 years, so I've been lucky in that sense. But like my first year or two of coaching, if I had a parent come in, you know, if I had a new athlete in the facility that I was working with, and you know, I honestly had a fear that if they saw us standing there, like in between sprints, like we did a set of jumps, box jumps, and I'd start my watch for 3 or 4 minutes for rest. And we're just standing there. The father's going to be like, well, what's the waste of my money? Like, what am I paying for? You're just standing there? Like, you should be doing stuff. Like, why is it my son, you know, hands on his knees, like, feeling like he's about to puke? Like, I don't understand. Or it's like, you're just taking my money because you're not having them do enough. You're not a good coach. So I can really commiserate with that a lot. Like, it's a shame that it's kind of looked at that way when it's like, I'm actually doing better for your son because I'm having them rest enough in between this set of, you know, plyometrics so that they're going to get more out of it. They're not going to get hurt from being fatigued. It's like really something you have to be mindful of as a coach to not let that mindset bleed into what you're doing and like really stay strong in that regard.
Yeah, I'm really good friends with Brian Kula, who is the trainer of Christian McCaffrey.
I was about to bring that up. I've quoted that article 50 times to my athletes that want to just work nonstop.
Well, when I read that, I was like, holy cow, this guy's feeding the cats. He's read my stuff. And so I called him. He said, I've never heard of you. So, so anyway, isn't that great? But we've become best of friends since then. And so we were drinking beer one night, and I said, okay, I'm not a big weight room guy. We can talk about this later, but I'm not a big weight room guy. Give me your 20%. McCaffrey says everything he does in the weight room is like a track athlete. He lifts like a track athlete. Tell me what in the hell is the secret sauce. So he said, okay, this is it. 3 heavy concentric lifts of the deadlift. Drop it at the top. 3 heavy ones, and then superset it with some type of plyo, you know, whether it's hurdle hops or something like that, some type of pogo jumps or, you know, whatever you call it.
Yeah, well, and then French contrast type thing, yeah.
100%.
Yep.
And then with no eccentric, of course, there's no soreness the next day. And then you have them sit down for 5 minutes and let the ATPs come back. And he says, oh, Christian hates that sitting. He hates it. He keeps looking at me like, God, this is the longest 5 minutes of my life. But then he does it again. He does 3 sets of those. I said, so that's the secret? He goes, that's absolutely the secret. It's all Barry Ross stuff. And but the whole thing, like, I'm training this kid in Pennsylvania, this generic wide receiver high school kid that's really getting fast right now. And I said, now, do you lift with your team? He goes, oh, yeah, yeah. And I go, what would your coach do if he saw you sitting for 5 minutes? He said, well, you kicked me out of the weight room.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're dealing with, like, what Christian McCaffrey does that's the most important thing that he does would not be allowed in a high school weight room.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just interesting. I love stuff like that.
Yeah, I've quoted that article. I've made posts about it. Like, I had an athlete come in the gym and they were like, coach, you know, on the days that I'm not here, I've been doing, like, and now mind you, this is a hard gainer. He's 155 pounds, like he needs to gain weight. You know, he's in a very, very strong football conference in New Jersey. Like, he's not gonna play if he's 155 pounds. Like, it's not gonna happen, right? And he goes, I'm doing speed work, an extra day of speed work when I'm not with you. So it's like, oh God, like, well, okay, what is that? Right? Like, I knew it was coming. And he says, yeah, I do like a sprint and then like I you know, turn around, rest a couple seconds, and I do another one. I was like, all right, you're not doing speed work. Let's just get that out of the way. That's not what you're doing. It's like you're conditioning yourself and you're making it even harder for you to gain weight with the food that you're eating, because your food that you're eating is basically set around like the regular energy levels and what you're doing. And you're just going and adding stuff that you don't need to do. So if you want to get faster, like, you're getting faster. We're doing sprints here. We're doing jumps here. Like, we're doing all of that. Like, just keep on the course. Yeah. But like, I feel lazy, like I'm not doing anything on that day. Like, what am I? I was like, all right. So I went and found the article, the McCaffrey article. I was like, all right, like, if this kid plays football and he's not going to listen to me, he's definitely going to listen to what Christian McCaffrey did because of the season he just had and the type of athlete that he is. And I went and found the article, and I was like, listen, if you had to guess, how many hours a week would you say Christian McCaffrey trains? I don't know, probably 4 or 5 a day. I was like, 6 for the week.
Yeah.
So I was like, break it down. We're here 1.5 hours, 3 days a week. I was like, we're getting pretty close to that 6 hours already, right? And he was like, yeah, that kind of makes sense. I was like, all right, like just stick to the plan here. Next thing you know, he gained 10 pounds the next 2 months. So it's like, you have to really, you know, give them these examples. Like, they sometimes don't believe it unless they see it from a high level athlete like that, right? Like, you need to sometimes show them that, even if they, you know, we could have all the accolades in the world, all the following in the world, but sometimes people look at us like, oh, it's like just some random guy on Twitter. Why would I listen to him? Well, it's like, all right, well, here's the guy who trains Christian McCaffrey and here's what he's doing. So like, maybe take that for an example. Here's what Mike Trout does, or here's what LeBron is doing. I don't know if LeBron even does good stuff, but I'm just saying, like, here are what the top athletes in their sport are doing. Like, you should maybe align yourself with them and, you know, take what I'm saying to heart and really do it.
Yeah, you can imagine. I'm absolutely, you know, like, building mass on a sprinter will never make them faster. But I think it's important that we mention that with that hard gainer, that kid that weighs 155, he has to gain weight. He has to get big. And that's the cool thing about my sprint training program is that for those people, when they gain weight, they may actually become faster because they're sprinting along with it.
Yeah.
If you're doing, it just makes no sense at all to be doing hypertrophy stuff in the weight room and then endurance work that counteracts what you're doing. That's just the dumbest thing in the world. And those kids that want to work harder too, here's another thing. A lot of times the kids that want to work their ass off, they don't want to sleep. You know, they want to sleep 5.5 hours at night, and they don't want to hear that doing 2 hours less work and getting 2 more hours of sleep will increase the dopamine and testosterone in their body that allow them to grow up physically and become a better athlete. I think sleep and sunshine are the two most underrated things in sprinting and probably athleticism overall.
Yeah, and I think, too, like you mentioned, the sleep, it's like getting, again, and just reiterating this, getting out of that mindset that, you know, you have to do more to get better, and it's just like, people think there's like this instant karma that if they're working really hard, like the man upstairs is going to just see that and grant them the results that they're looking for. And it's like, it doesn't work that way. Like, you need to find what's effective and what works and do just enough of it to get what you need out of it, and then that's enough. Like, it really is a mindset you have to, you know, be cognizant of. And it's always not always like, you know, am I really, really sore? And that's a good thing. Like, yeah, sometimes it makes you feel that you know, you did something, but, you know, what's the enemy of that? Like, if I did my strength work and I have to go sprint later in the week and I have all this muscle sore, and it's like, did I really help myself? Or, you know, what did I really do? Did I, you know, was it to the detriment of the sprint work and the speed work that I wanted to get done? And I think that's just something that many really need to understand and just know that there's a time and a place for everything. But as long as it actually is kind of building up to what your goals are and what you're trying to improve.
Yeah, that stuff about, you know, a lot of people don't realize, and I think, I mean, your industry is definitely, its roots is back in the, you know, no pain, no gain type of thinking. But, you know, Charlie Francis is probably the favorite sprint coach of all weight room guys. And he used to say that athletes should never be sore from training, which is pretty revolutionary. And I have taken that just a little bit different, that that my full quote is this, that today's workout should never ruin tomorrow's workout, which by putting the words workout in there, that's important because that actually allows us during the track season to do acidosis tolerance work, which is just freaking dreadful, awful stuff. I have to apologize to my kids before we do it every single time. But I always tell them we have tomorrow off. So even though it's a dreadful workout with a 48-hour hangover, it doesn't ruin tomorrow's workout because we don't have a workout tomorrow. In the same vein, when I worked with a football coach for 13 years, and all football coaches are no pain, no gain guys. I mean, they all are, or almost all up. And I used to tell him, I said, just do one thing. Don't crush kids on their legs until the Thursday session. And the reason for that is because we didn't work out on Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So by telling them to do that, my best sprinters who sprinted before they lifted on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, never had that terrible squat hangover, which I think can last 72 hours maybe. And so he would wait and crush them on Thursday, which never ruined the next day's workout. I think that's important.
Yeah, for sure. And that just all kind of comes back to as well, like having an act, and we alluded to this before with, you know, even as a coach with the work we're doing while we're home during this time or just in general, like having a schedule and having things kind of built out to like know when things need to happen. Like that is such a huge part of what, you know, we do. And when I say we, I mean sport coaches, strength coaches, speed, the track coaches, like our relationships together that are going to make the athletes themselves better. Like there needs to be a collaboration of sorts, but even within the, you know, each silo, so to speak, there needs to be that understanding of like, okay, my schedule is this, like what's going to be built, what schedule, like what do I need to build it? How do I need to build it to be the most effective? So like, you know, I'm sprinting first day of the week so that I know that, you know, we're doing it fully recovered and fully fresh. I'm not hitting two big lifts on a Monday and Wednesday and then sprinting on a Thursday. It's like, all right, like that's going to be a recipe for disaster and really not do much for us versus saying like, all right, we just had, you know, Friday, Saturday, Sunday off, you know, and we're going to sprint Monday. All right. Well, that's probably going to lead to a little more success. So I think having a schedule and an understanding of, how things are structured is such a big part of it.
Yeah, you know your stuff, because a lot of people don't get that about sprinting. Sprinting can only be beneficial if it's done when you're fresh.
Yeah,
that's why. Let's say you know, like with our winter program, we want at least, you know, we have about 100 kids, and we want the better half of our runners to sprint first, lift second. And that's the best way to do it. The second best way to do it is to lift first and sprint second. So, but at least for the skilled athletes and the kids that are going to score touchdowns for you and all that kind of stuff, they need to sprint train when they're fresh. If a kid comes in to a track practice and I can see he's tired or upset, you know, I'll say, hey, just take today off. And a lot of times they argue with me because they really love track practice. And but I do not want to do that. Sometimes I hear like, you know, people want advice like, OK, my kid needs to get faster this summer. And I said, well, you know, you got to train them when they're fresh. He goes, well, he's playing basketball, baseball, and he's, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, OK, he won't get any faster because he'll never be fresh. He goes, well, he doesn't have anything on Sundays. I go, okay, train one speed on Monday morning then. You know, at least maybe he might be fresh on Monday morning. So, yeah, you cannot practice. I mean, I think sprinting is the most intense activity in the world. You know, that when you're moving your body 10 meters a second or 11 meters a second, there is nothing in the weight room that is like that. And so, you know, it's such a CNS driven thing that your CNS has really got to be rebooted and fresh and all that stuff, or you're just not going to get faster.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just like we mentioned the plyos before too. It's like people just need to really understand, like if you're not going, and I talk about the plyometric effect of sprinting, and it's like, what better plyo effect is there than the, you know, intensity of a ground contact time that is like, in the most elite sprinters, 0.089, like, you know, like it's really just such a small window, but such a max, there's so much force in that, such that small amount of time. Like there's not much, there's nothing really that rivals that, but you're not getting that if it's not done, at the max speed. But something that I did want to talk to you about in that sense is there are times where the submax work could be useful. I guess if you're talking like a mechanic standpoint, you know, let's say temp, and we're talking about aerobic work before, if you're going to do it, like, you know, maybe get, you know, more bang for your buck out of it with some tempo runs. You could work on mechanics of top speed and stuff. And I've heard a lot of track coaches, you know, they want this, to be clarified in terms of like, letting people know that yes, we're saying you need to sprint fast to get fast, but where are the times where that submax work could be useful in terms of mechanical approach and things like that?
Yeah, this is where I'm pretty radical. Charlie Francis believed that, you know, you sprint three times a week. You know, I think that's a – now, if you're 10 years old, you can sprint every damn day because your outputs are so low. If you're slow –
it's like you could drive your Kia every day, but your Ferrari maybe not so much.
Exactly. If you're slower in hell, you can sprint every day, and you probably should. But if you are a skilled athlete, two or three times a week, probably three for a high school kid. But what he would do is he would come in and do tempo runs on their non-sprint days. And we do zero, absolutely freaking zero tempo running, because that's running, and we gave up running.
Yeah.
Now, you could say that our wake-up drills, I don't like calling them warm-up because warm-up sounds sloppy and slow, that our speed drills, wake-up drills, you could say that that's not max speed and we're not spiked up. And that's true, but we are max intensity. If we're bounding, we are bounding with full intensity. If we are doing high knees, we are doing high knees so freaking fast that it's not going to last for more than 6 or 7 seconds. Mm-hmm. And so we are absolutely full intensity at all times. We do zero endurance work, zero aerobic focused work. And it's interesting I bring back Brian Kula. Brian Kula and I have basically arrived in this. It's kind of like, you know, how evolution sometimes will, you know, produce an animal on one island that's very similar to an animal on another island, just based on evolving into a certain niche. And that's what Kula and I have done. We evolved into the same niche without ever knowing each other. And so with McCaffrey, not only was he practicing, you know, like, what did he say, 5 or 6 hours a week or whatever, but also they did zero submax work, zero, nothing less than 95%. Now, like I say, you know, like, you know, the speed drills and stuff that they were doing, or, you know, like straight legged bounce and stuff. Obviously, they weren't going 100 miles an hour, but they were going 100%, or he calls it 95 to 100%. And
for what that drill allowed, right? Like that was the 100% of what that drill. You know, you can't do some of those drills at the same speed as others, but it means the effort is still there with that particular drill.
Correct. And this is where I know you want to get into this because it's fascinating. When you would think that McCaffrey going through 6 months of that type of stuff would really, he would be probably the worst prepared athlete to do one of those stupid conditioning tests that every football program seems to do. But he went down there and won. He was number one in the Panthers conditioning test with zero aerobic focus. Mm-hmm. And I had always said that you could get aerobically fit.
Just to clarify for the listeners, do you know what your specific test was, the Panthers? Like, what was their conditioning test? Was it like the 110s? What was it? Do you know?
I do not know. You know, I said it on one podcast. It was one of those 16 110s.
Yes. But okay, so something like that.
After I said it, I thought, I don't remember if Brian really told me. It may have been a 300 shuttle or whatever.
Either way, it was something that people would think they need to train for with a lot of aerobic stuff. And here's this guy that literally did none of it and dominated the friggin' test.
Zero. Now, yes. And in that, yeah, I know. Yeah, I just get a warm glow when I hear about this because every time we focus on aerobic work, we damage mechanics. We damage the CNS. We lessen the power and speed gains that we have worked so hard to accomplish. So part of the whole feed the cats deal is that we're not going to do anything that interferes with speed and power. And I used to say that we can get aerobically fit by crowding together anaerobic work. And then I heard Brian Kula talk, and he said we get aerobically fit by stacking.
Which is what Christian did the entire offseason, was literally go out on the field and run his route tree at full speed and take the rest in between like he would. And he would just go up and down the field. Like he would go down the field basically, right? Yep. Like the idea of stacking those bouts together. It's funny you mentioned he goes in and he finishes first in this conditioning test. I have a lot of hockey athletes that like have to do, you know, the beep test or, things like that. And we literally, I will say with the hockey guys, I train the energy systems a little differently just because of the dynamics of a shift and getting on and off the ice. The only stuff we're really working a lot of lactic power during the off season as we get closer to the season. But like I know so many kids like come in and they run, you know, a couple miles, a couple times a week and stuff, and they finish worse in the beep test than my guys who were sprinting and doing like that type of training all summer. So it's interesting in that sense that like it turns out that way.
I totally believe that. And it turns upside down everything we were ever taught, you know. And another, it really doesn't have a lot to do with athletes, but, you know, I ran like, you know, a couple miles this morning but I know that I would be a leaner adult right now if I sprinted instead of jogged. And it's just magic, you know, that there's something about high intensity work that is good for, you know, body fat, for speed, power, and somehow we even get well conditioned by doing it. You know, my track kids are trained with minimal dosage. My kids never run a lap all season. We never run further than 200 meters in practice. But my 4x4, you know, had a chance to probably be top five in the state this year. Those kids are trained with such low dosage that it just does not make any sense. But, you know, I'm here saying it works.
Yeah, it's just the proof is there. And I feel like so many people, like I remember even in college, like having to do a 300 shuttle and like doing really well with it. And I never did any long distance stuff. It's just, it's crazy kind of how that works. And I still don't understand it. Like, why is there still such an insistence that team sports need to have this emphasis on the aerobic system? Or even training in a lactic state. Like I work with a lot of baseball players and the coach is still saying like, oh, you need to get out and run your poles, after you pitch. And the thought process is like, I've had a couple coaches tell athletes of mine this year, like, if you're not breaking a sweat and feeling it really well, it's not working. I'm like, if you're telling them to go out there and run a pole to break up lactic acid, so like, let's just put to the side of the fact that that makes no sense, first of all. But then you're telling them they have to break a sweat and run really hard. It's like, if anything, that's just putting them back in a lactic state. So like, what are we really accomplishing there? I don't understand that. Like, it just makes no sense to me. And it reminds me of when I was like 15 and my pitching coach told me to run poles. And, you know, the young strength coach in me at the time, I didn't know I wanted to be a strength coach, but I guess it's funny how it works out, separated his poles. I would run one pole really fast and then rest. And he was like, what are you doing? You're not supposed to stop. And I was like, yeah, but like when I pitch, I stop in between. So I was trying to like structure it how I would pitch. And he told me I had to keep running one after the other. So it's just funny.
Yep. I would train every pitcher the same way Christian McCaffrey trains for football. Speed and power. And, you know, all that stuff about so-and-so back in the 60s used to, you know, be an endurance runner. It doesn't matter. You know, you want to be speed, you know, fast and powerful. And yeah, you want to be a Ferrari out there. You don't want to be, you know, a long distance, you know, animal at all. So I don't understand why. I think it still goes down to it's hard. You know, because it's hard, it's good. You know, because there's pain and suffering, you know, that's what we need to do. And no, I'd want all my pitchers to be racehorses.
Yeah, for sure. I just because I want to touch on this a little more about the stacking anaerobic bouts on top of one another. When I was writing this outline, I kind of had this thought pop in my head and thought about it like this, like the best defense is a strong offense, so to speak. So it's like, I feel like going the opposite direction with always worrying about the aerobic capacity is like, you know, my dad always used to say, I mean, I guess now's a bad time to kind of reference this considering that like if you had disaster insurance on your business, you'd be doing really well. But like he always used to tell me, like, don't be insurance rich and money poor. And it's like the people that like put all of this money and time and invest into like the what ifs of like the damaging scenarios. I think I take that as like the equivalent of putting all of your time into the aerobic system. And it's like, you're going to put all of your stock into something you're never really going to need when if you really just kind of got after it with the anaerobic, bouts and like the activities where, you know, I need to exert max, at maximum effort and then rest a little bit. How much better am I going to get at being able to exert max output for longer periods of time, meaning like I can exert 10 max effort bouts near my top speed or within 5% of my top speed versus 6 that I did the month before. Like I'm going to be way more effective in a sport like football or baseball, whatever, if I'm at 10 than if I was at 6. And you're not going to get to 10 by doing aerobic work. You're going to get to 10 by conditioning in that anaerobic area to be able to exert high-end bouts for more repetitions, right?
Yeah, I love your analogy. Being from a non-business family, I've never heard insurance poor or insurance rich. And
it was the first thing you said to me. I was like, should I get this insurance? I'm starting my business up and like I'm getting advice from people and they're like, get this insurance and then get that insurance. He's like, yeah, you're going to be insurance rich and money poor. You're going to have no money because all your money goes to insurance.
So you take your money and you invest it in what matters, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And see, that's the thing that, one of the things I have a hard time getting through to coaches is that my undertrained sprinters, the last 100 of the 400 meters is going to suck. It's really going to suck. But they're going to be in the lead with 100 meters to go. They're going to love the sport, and they're going to fight through it, you know, because they're cats. And the guys that are overtrained, overtraining does not make the last 100 meters easy. It's going to suck for them too. But the difference is that they're not going to be as fast as my kids. So, you know, that's one way to look at it. Another thing that I say all the time is in programming, allow the game or the race or, you know, whatever to be the hardest thing you do during the week. That is so hard for coaches. My father used to say, we're going to practice so hard that the games will be easy. Basically, I mean, it made sense to him and it made sense to his players, but he's 100% wrong. Because by going so hard during the week, you've actually slowed your team down. You have more injuries and they come with dead eyes on game night. And, you got to allow the game to be the hardest thing you do. And when you do that, you are training speed and power, the things that matter during the week. And then you get to rest after the game. And over the course of the season, you allow the games to become, you know, actually the conditioning that you do, you know, and instead of conditioning for the games, you're letting the games get you in shape. And there's no more specific way to get into the proper shape to play your sport than to actually play your sport.
Yeah, for sure. And that's another thing too. Like, I've had conversations with so many good strength coaches who talk about the importance of just watching the sport of the athletes that you train. Like, I never played hockey in my life. Like, I've been on ice twice with skates and I fell on my ass every single time. But I still train hockey athletes and I've had to just sit and watch all of them play the sport and just really see, like, they don't skate up and down the ice for 30 straight seconds at full speed. Like, they're in a set on half the ice and they're passing the puck around. Then they do one hard sprint after the puck or two maybe in a shift. Then they come off the ice. Like, you have to condition that way or else you're wasting your time. And like you said, like, if they're out there twice or three times a week on the ice, that's going to condition them. And if you maybe wanted to play devil's advocate and do it, and I always just go this way just because I always make sure to just really cover my bases with them because I don't want coaches to like, the way we are in the hockey industry, unfortunately, so much like the football one is like, if there's any sense of the athlete being deconditioned, the coach will just write them off. So I never want to put them in that position. But like putting the assault bike out and letting them do, you know, interval based training on the assault bike, similar to what, you know, the, ice shift would be, or like I said, working lactic power. Like I have sometimes where I would have the guys, lactic power saying, okay, they just kind of skated up and down the ice a little bit and they're fatigued, but now they had to just kind of bust it after a puck. And we want to train them to be able to exert as much force as possible or as much speed as possible. In that fatigue state. So we would maybe get on the bike for 20 hard seconds and they go right over and, do some kind of like sprint work to kind of mimic that frame of reference of like that lactic presence is there, but they still have to exert kind of max speed. So maybe we do some of that and that'll really prepare them for kind of what they're getting used to on the ice. But you hit the nail on the head there. Like, there's no better way to condition for your sport than the sport itself, right?
Yeah, and I think coaches get way ahead of themselves and they want to be like well conditioned on day one. Eric Corum put out something this week that I thought was brilliant. He said coaches need to learn how to be uncomfortable with how little they do in the first week.
Yeah.
And I tweeted out and I said, actually, they need to be a little uncomfortable with how little they do all year. In other words, it's really saying what we're saying now is, you know, let the game be the hardest thing you do. Otherwise, you're not going to be training speed and power. You're going to be training sloppy ass play, you know, sloppy mechanics, slow running. And you just don't want that. And one of the things that just dawned on me when you're saying, you know, mimicking the game, well, you know, like a college football player will play like 6 minutes of football in a 3 hour game. And, you know, and that alone to me is like, okay,
crazy.
I think I know, yeah. I know how to train this guy. We need to train him super fast. And we actually need to teach his body, teach his physiology, how to recover.
If you're doing those anaerobic activities, I apologize for cutting you off. You kind of just hit something, just kind of,
no, good.
A light bulb went off in my head. You're doing those anaerobic bouts and stacking them on top of each other. What better way to get a body to be able to recover from them than doing them in succession of each other with rest, right? Like that's the best way to do it. Like it makes so much sense.
Yeah. You know, like, I mean, in an NFL football game, there's 80 minutes of the game, of the televised game, 80 minutes shows grown men loitering. I mean, like they're just standing. And so instead of having this activity, you know, like hustle here, hustle there, hustle here, hustle there, there needs to be more loitering in football practice. Because what you're doing is you're teaching the body how to recover, you know, a 5 second pass route, 25 seconds rest. That 25 seconds, the body has to learn how to do that. And if you're in constant motion in practice, you've never learned how to do that. And then you also have to learn how to, you know, like if you're a wide receiver again, and you just had a drive that lasted, you know, on your watch 11 minutes, you're not going back on the field for maybe another 11 minutes. So if you're doing like endurance type practices, your body never learns how to become the machine it needs to become to be a good player.
Yeah, for sure. And like again, it's just so simple. If you just really take a look at the fact that like you're not going to be good at the requirements of what you're doing in a game if you never really like you're running, doing something for a minute straight or a minute and a half straight or running miles at a time. Like that's not what your body is going to be doing in a team sport. You know, it varies from sport to sport. Like it's a little different in each, but in most team sports, and I always stress this when I tweet about this stuff, like I'm speaking to team sport, the team sport area, like the team sport coaches, team sport strength coaches, like things like that. Like that is, if that's the, what dominates your sport, like why would you train any other way? And it's just a shame that it seems so basic and so easy to understand, but we still have people not doing it. And I like to even say to some, to make them understand it, is the idea of increasing your max output. So if my 40 time in the most, let's say the football player, if my 40 time is like the most ideal in the most ideal settings is 4.5, and I can get that down to 4.35, let's just say. That's my max output now means that when I am operating at lower levels of that, my operational output, it's taxing my system less. So by improving how fast I was overall, I did my energy systems a favor, right? Like,
yeah. Yep. It's called speed reserve.
Yep.
It's called when you raise the roof, you raise the floor as well.
Yep.
It is why it is totally counterintuitive to work on max speed for a basketball player because the court is not long enough to ever get to max speed.
Much however, like I wouldn't work on it with hockey players. It's a lot of acceleration.
It is true, but this may surprise you some, is that if I'm able to turn a 19-mile-an-hour guy into a 22-mile-an-hour guy, mm-hmm. then even 17 miles an hour feels so much easier. Mm-hmm. You're so much more under control. I would be... You know, this is the counterintuitive part, that there are sports that are nothing but acceleration sports. But I have found that max speed work improves your acceleration better than anything I know. And so the opposite's not true. Acceleration does nothing for your max speed.
Yeah.
But you know, that's why I would advocate for max speed training with all athletes.
Can I ask you this?
Golfers, but you know,
let me ask you this.
I'm a big max speed person.
Let's say for baseball, and I agree. Like even with like I have my baseball guys. Like we are still doing a lot of top speed work, but it'd be more geared of like think of like flying 10s, flying 20s, where you maybe get a little bit more of close to the fact that they're hitting those mechanics, but in something, it's a little more conducive to baseball, I guess, just based on the way the sport is constructed versus having them do like a, you know, 60 to 100 yard sprint, right? Like,
maybe correct. I think that what you're saying, you're being very specific, which that's perfect. But the thing that I might be able to add is that if you could run them in a 40, which sounds weird because they never run a 40, they run 60s, don't they? You know, like, okay, well, in baseball, the 60?
Yes, for the testing, yeah, for like okay, a combine right. showcase, right. yeah.
So the reason why I would never run a 60 is because anything more than 5 seconds is no longer working on speed.
Yeah.
I heard that 18 years ago, and I'll never forget it. And, you know, anything more than 5 seconds is no longer working on speed. It's working on something else. It might be okay, but it's not working on speed anymore.
Isn't it crazy that we still use that, though? Like, I don't understand, but I've ranted on this enough.
I don't understand that either. But the reason why I love the 40, and the reason why the 40 is still the key, okay, among everybody that goes to the combine of similar ability and size, the KPI for going in the early rounds is always the 40, with the possible exception of quarterbacks. Even for the biggest guys, the tackles, the centers, the guards, your ability to run the 40 is the KPI, the key performance indicator that will, I mean, if you're an offensive tackle and you go in and run 5:38, you may not get drafted.
Yeah.
If you're an offensive tackle and you go in and run 4:95, you're a first rounder and a millionaire.
Yeah.
So there's such a global impact.
And that makes so much sense of why it is. Even for alignment, it's like they're going, it's how well they're moving themselves from a static position, like how important that is from when you're trying to block somebody in front of you and they, you know, you snap the ball, you have to move from a static position. Like how much power, that's just like, it's a no brainer.
And what you said is exactly where I connect the dots. Your ability to not only accelerate the first half of the 40 is an acceleration, but also go max speed, the second half of a 40 is max speed. Your ability to do those things that max speed component allows you to be at a better accelerator. And another thing, just to throw it in here, what they found is that fast, big guys age well. The age that slow never ages well. Mm-hmm. If you think about that, it makes a lot of sense. Slow never ages well. And Tom Petty, never slow down, never grow old.
All right. So that was awesome. And it kind of just touched on everything that I wanted to get to that I had kind of written up. And I kind of wanted to finish up with, I had a couple common myths. I labeled it common myths and ridiculousness. A couple things that I wanted to like kind of run through with you so we could dispel some of this stuff. And then I want to just go through a couple questions that we got from Twitter when I posted yesterday, to kind of wrap things up, if that works for you.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Perfect. So speed ladders,
yep.
Idea of quick feet. It's just like, even with change of direction and force application and stuff like that, like I always kind of like to present this to everybody that I have on, but, talk a little bit to the athletes who think, you know, they're struggling with their speed and need to get their feet quicker.
Yeah, that has nothing to do with it. It's all of the amount of force you're able to put into the ground, and the force is in acceleration is a force that's pushing you. And then in max speed, it's a vertical force that's going directly down into the ground. Mm. And it's all about that vertical force. And it's not anything about, I think if they called it agility ladders, I wouldn't make fun of them. And then of course have you heard the quote from Bouchexnader about that?
Yes. What was it? The best piano players have the best fastballs, right?
I think it's if speed ladders made you faster, then the best piano players would be the best pitchers.
Yeah, they'd have like the fastest fastballs. Yeah, and even and Mike Boyle's been saying a lot too, like that I love is last time I checked, your feet were attached to your knees and hips and everything, your legs. Like last time I checked.
Yep. Yeah. So yeah, don't do that.
Yeah, I've been talking about the Fred Flintstone analogy, where so many kids think that their feet need to move the way his do when he gets in his car and he's ready to go, and it's like, nope, speed doesn't work that way. You don't just like rev your feet up really quick and just kind of, you know, shoot out of a slingshot. Like it's, you know, the strides are bigger. It's not just that quick repetitive motion, but it's funny how many people have that misconception.
I actually heard you on a podcast one time say something, that not many people get. And, you know, one of the cues to acceleration is fewest steps wins.
Yeah.
And I believe you were talking about getting somebody who has taken 7 steps to go a certain distance to take 5.5. And that makes a huge difference, because the only way you do that is by really putting a lot of force into the ground, which is the key to acceleration.
Yeah. And I think, so that was an athlete, one of the first athletes I ever really had. And lucky for me, he gave me a chance to work with him, because the results we got and the progress we made were huge. And, you know, me kind of getting my, my flag into the ground, so to speak, and showing people, you know, that I could do some stuff. But, we really like, again, I know we talked about the pitfalls of running a 60, but if that's the indication of speed for baseball, we got a 60 time down. You know, I only have 20 yards of track in my facility. It's like 20 yards of turf. So we did a lot of 10 and 15 yard sprint work, and we got his number of strides down from about 7 to about 5.5, 6-ish, in his 10 yeah. yards. And it made a huge difference for him. But I will say something though, and I definitely want to run this by you. I put a post about this Sunday, that I got a lot better though at understanding that you don't get those strides down by over-cueing long strides, because you're going to end up with an entire other host of issues with that. And that was something that like I really unfortunately did early on that I realize now like isn't what you want to do to go about it. And like you kind of said, let it happen as the result of other things that you're doing, not trying to get the strides longer themselves, right?
Yeah, massive pushes. The only two cues I use, I'll say fewest steps wins sometimes, or don't spin your wheels. But my two cues is always, you know, what to do with the arms, and that's split and rip. That basically your hands split apart front to back, and then you rip back through. And then the other thing is push, push, push. Mm. You know, that they're just massive pushes that you're trying to get your damn hips out of there. And then, of course, in track, we have to talk all the time that what the worst coaches say all the time is actually the one thing you can't do, and that's to try to stay low. Because when people stay low,
you start to bend at the waist, it's a whole mess.
Oh, it's horrible.
I call it false angle. Not like that, not the good angle you get. It's like you're bending at the hips, you restrict your hips. It's just
fake,
a mess.
Fake low.
Yeah.
It's a fake low. I actually saw a head track coach at a good school one time holding some type of rod or something.
Oh my God. I would drive you nuts if I told you what one of my athletes did one time at a speed school. They had a string. they put strings down the turf and you had to run underneath them. He came into me. He was running like he was like the Hunchback of Notre Dame.
Yeah. I'm thinking even like shoots in football, you know, I think there's a lot of artificial low stuff coming from that as well, that we need to just try to get our hips, you know, like project our hips forward. Yeah. You know, that's what we're trying to do. Big, strong, massive pushes.
Yeah, for sure. All right. You ready for a couple questions?
Yeah.
All right. So, first one comes from Corbin Brown at Brown SHS. I think I know the answer to this, but when athletes want to lift during the season, when and how would you implement it? What lifts would you focus on and why? So we talked about this a little bit with you talked about McCaffrey and the concentric only deadlifts and stuff, but I guess more to the in season part of it. Like, what would you advise for that?
I would say the closest thing to a feed the cats approach to lifting I've ever read is the Barry Ross Underground Secrets, and basically. He liked lifting for power in small doses, mm-hmm. No reps of more than 3, in and out of the weight room quick. But you know, it was heavy. So it was very much a feat, you know, like even though we don't do many reps, we do our reps freaky fast, you know? So, you know, a feed the cats approach in the weight room would be minimal. It would be intense. It would never ruin the next day unless you didn't have a workout the next day. And I think to the fact that in feed the cats, we time kids, you know, like three times a week, that my kids that don't run fast, because they squatted too much the day before, they start to understand, you know, what lifts really interfere with their sprinting. And, you know, what I say about in season, this is probably the most important in season track, you never want a secondary recovery issue. Your primary recovery issue is the recovery from sprinting, from track meets and things like that. You never want to add a secondary recovery issue from lifting. So if you can lift, that's why concentric is pretty good, or isometric. If you can lift without ruining, you know, other workouts, then that's okay. Yeah. And I will also say that I don't see much difference in the speed gains of people that are big lifters compared to non-lifters. Speed is so specific. It's crazy specific.
And I talked about this a little bit yesterday, like maybe with a really low training age or a really rudimentary level athlete where like any type of improvement in their force application is going to help them. But like you're starting to split hairs. Like I had a question someone sent me and I thought it was really great to make a whole thread on it about like, hey, an athlete squats 130 kg versus one that squats 90 kg. Like, is the 130 likely to be faster? And I went on a whole big thing about like, you know, don't confuse technical proficiency with a certain lift to like that force being able to be applied to other areas and different planes and the rate in which they can produce it and the whole aspect of stiffness with sprinting. Like it, there's so many things that come along with it than for us to just assume it's almost insulting to assume something so complex would be directly related to it. Could it help? Yeah. But like, there's so many more things that go into it that like, you can't just assume that, oh, I ran faster this month. It's got to be because my squat's better or my deadlift's better. Like, it could have a part in it for sure, but it's probably a lot to do with the fact that you were sprinting and improving in that sense as well. So, or even more so that. So I think that's an important distinction for sure. This comes from Richard Armstrong, R.A.R. Armstrong. How would you introduce speed training to team sport athletes who have had only ever quote unquote played the game?
Yeah, it, you got a lot of work ahead of you because, I say that, you know, like in the art of war, they say that, the three things, the way you win wars is misdirection, power, and speed. Well, misdirection is what coaches do, you know, like 8 hours a day, you know, in football and stuff, you know, and then power, that's the weight room. And then the neglected thing is the thing that most S&C people think or football coaches think are just God-given things, you know, so why work on speed? And, you know, anybody that works in speed knows that it's every bit as you can develop speed every bit as you can develop strength. So you've got to work on it. The way I would do it is, I mean, buy my DVD and implement Feed the Cats. I mean, you can take 40 kids through a speed session in 45 minutes. And that's what you got to do. And it's not hard. Basically, you go through some intense speed drills, you know, really being demanding and teaching sprinting every day. And then you time them three times, spiked up, and record, rank, and publish. And you do that three times a week, and you do it fresh. And you realize that that many in your group are going to suck, you know. I mean, and you can't spend all your time with the kids that suck. You know, you got to, you know, you've got to kind of assemble the plane as it's flying. And so, you know, you do that and then realize that you're really talking about like a 4-year plan here. I mean, I've had dozens of athletes come into high school running 5.3s and leave running 4.3s. You know, they didn't have big jumps in 2 days. You know, they had big jumps from, you know, month to month or season to season. But, you know, it's definitely one of those things. I think that's why people love the weight room so much. Is that you can have huge jumps in 8 weeks. You know, you can get really good feedback. And I always say the speed grows like a tree. And, you know, the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And, you know, the second best time is right now.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's going to take a lot of work, you know, that is, you know, that to get faster is really a pursuit of very small gains and no setbacks.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Last one. John Bile, creating buy-in to a minimal dose program. We kind of talked about this a little bit before. How do you handle the kids who are used to more submax running and think this is the difference maker?
Well, I mean, I hate to say it, but coaches have to be able to sell, you know, ice to Eskimos. Mm. You know, I mean, if you can't sell your shit, you ain't going to be a very good coach. You know, every great coach you had, every great coach I had was so charismatic that they could sell a bad program to us.
Yep.
You know, and I hate to say it, but most of the programs I participated in were bad programs.
Yeah.
But I still bought in. I still love my coach. I still love the competition and the games. I accepted that everybody hated practice. That's just the way sports are. We hate practice and love the games. Now, Feed the Cats turns that upside down, where I want them to love practice and we're going to kick ass in the games. You know, that's a lot better than the other way around. But yeah, you have to, that's why I tell people that Feed the Cats is a way to cook. It's not a recipe. Now, if you want the recipe, I give you the recipe I have as of right now, but it's an evolving recipe. Mm. And, you know, you could give somebody an actual recipe and they could screw up.
Mm. Just like my mother can't make the same meatballs my grandmother does because she just stands by the stove and she knows exactly what to put in, but it doesn't work when someone else does it.
Oh, that's beautiful, because that goes back to my favorite word, nuance.
Yep.
It is the nuance. It is the, hey, if you see this, you need to do that, you know, and that might not have been in the recipe, but that's really, really important. And yeah, it's a pretty good way to end it.
For sure. So I think we kind of tied everything up here, but I would like to kind of leave off with this. If you have any closing thoughts, any, you know, things that you wanted to kind of get to that we didn't, or anything you wanted to kind of wrap up, you know, about what we talked about, you know, floor is yours.
Yeah, well, it's been fun, and I'm lucky enough to do a lot of different podcasts these days. You know, I've done them with, you know, distance coaches. I've done, of course, with track coaches. I've done, you know, but everybody I talk to makes me think and makes me defend stuff. And this has been a really good one. And I want to maybe advocate for the book I've been reading over break. I've been rereading The Stand. And I read it in 1991, Stephen King's book, The Stand, about the ultimate pandemic where 99.4% of the population died. And when I read it in 91, it was 13 years old. And here I'm rereading it 29 years later. And it's right now the number 11 selling book on Amazon.
Wow.
So I guess I'm not the only one that wants to read about a pandemic much worse than the one we're going through right now. So yeah, anytime I can promote reading, and not just reading of, like boring stuff from S&C people or something, but reading real books, I think makes our mind work better.
Yeah, absolutely. You can never learn too much. And like you said, just making sure that you kind of stimulate what you're applying. I think everyone talks about reading, but like applying what you're reading and or learning. And I think one of the better ways to do that, which you've alluded to a couple times, is to defend at what you're doing or have to explain it. It just makes you better at understanding it yourself. And I think if there's a takeaway for the listeners for this, is just to, in the learning sense, is to just make sure that you always kind of test yourself on what you're doing and making sure that you're applying it and seeing if, you know, how it works. And like you said, the recipe now versus how it'll change based on the feedback you see and the things you're getting from the athletes you're working with. It's just always evolving. So I think that's a kind of a great way to wrap things up. And I think that was awesome. So thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Hey, it's been a really good time for me. Thank you, and look forward to talking to you again someday.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Muscles and Management Podcast, brought to you by Challenger Strength. I'm your host, Jared DeFilippo, signing off on the show that's changing the way we view training, sports performance, and business.